Hello and welcome to the MicroISV show. I'm your host Michael Lehman, and today we're talking about building Project GlidePath, the software factory. Today I'm joined by Craig Krantz of Crow LLC, who helped us build the Project GlidePath software factory. So how are you doing today, Craig?
Oh, pretty good, Michael. How about yourself?
I'm doing fine. So, as I'm sure you well know, and probably a lot of our listeners know, we released the preview version, the technical preview of Project GlidePath to the web not quite 2 weeks ago. And we've had thousands of downloads, and we've had lots of really good feedback from people, and we're on track still for releasing the official version at the Shareware Industry Conference in Denver on July the 13th. And so today we're going to talk a little bit about the process of building the Project GlidePath software factory, and a little bit about what the purpose of it was and kind of some of the nuts and bolts for our listeners. So I guess the first question is, how long did it take to build Project GlidePath from start to finish?
Well, the concept, of course, by the time we were involved, Crow LLC was involved, the concept was of what features, what was trying to be accomplished was pretty much already set. But as far as building an architecture and actually writing the code, was about 4 months.
Yeah, it's one of those things in evangelism. We're given a very short fuse as we do these kind of things. It's not a major label effort, so to speak, with teams of developers and program managers. It's seat of the pants and just get it done and see what you can do in roughly 90 days. So in the process of building Project GlidePath, what do you think was going to be the most benefit to MicroISVs? What got you excited about GlidePath?
Well, the original concept was that MicroISVs were very good at writing code and may not have been as good at the business aspects. And Project GlidePath was going to provide a way of giving complete information to MicroISVs that they needed to build a product from beginning to end. And that included technical information, and it also included business information, so that once this fantastic product was built, people could actually go out and know how to market it and get paid for it and things like that. And I found that very interesting because my experience seems to reinforce that notion, that very often people are very good at the technical aspect and not as good at the business aspect, because that may not be the piece that they've done before. And the other thing about Project GlidePath is that was interesting was the attachment of some linear flow to things that we often encounter that are kind of fluid and abstracted, so that someone developing, for instance, within the technical arena of Project GlidePath, someone developing applications for Vista or some new technology may be able to go down through GlidePath's step-by-step workflow and get a pretty good idea of where to start, where to go next, what to look for, because very often the normal documentation is very fluid and circuitous, and you don't know really what to grab onto first. So that aspect of GlidePath was pretty exciting, the provision of an actual linear workflow to attach to even the technical aspects.
Yeah, as we've discovered from talking with a lot of people here, the documentation for our technologies is getting more precise because we're extracting a lot of the documentation from the actual source code itself. But in that process, you tend to lose the overview, or the what I always call the 30,000 foot view, so that you kind of know where to start in the first place and be able to see kind of end to end what it is you need to do.
Right, and this was providing that for both the technical and the non-technical aspects of the software business.
Right. So in the process of building the GlidePath software factory, Again, since most of our listeners here on Channel 9 are developers, let's just talk about the technology of it just a little bit. What was the most interesting technical problem that you had to deal with in trying to combine all these different technologies that we put in there between a plug-in architecture and downloading enclosures from RSS feeds and setting up the database and the integration into Visual Studio? You know, what did you find to be the most interesting thing in the process of building the technology?
Well, the technologies we were using, I mean, they all have their own little quirks and their own little interesting points. We use a lot of things like the data set, the generated data set classes for accessing the database that are kind of interesting technology. But internally, we came up with a very simple, straightforward architecture for the product, and actually the most interesting aspect technologically was that we pretty much had the capability of sticking to the original simple technology that we had described during the design meetings. And that's kind of exciting, because a lot of times as you're developing software, things change and you start diverting from what was maybe a very simple, elegant design. So, you know, it's nothing super groundbreaking technologically, but the fact that we describe how these technologies were going to interact and managed to maintain that interaction throughout the entire course of the project without any major diversion. I found that kind of interesting, because that doesn't happen very often.
Yeah, I agree. That was one of the more satisfying things, and I think one of the things that's driven by the fact that we had, you know, 3 or 4 months to get it done. You know, we kind of had to really hash those things out up front to make sure we kind of knew what we were doing. I mean, one of the things that people often talk about software development is that when you start getting a committee involved, you lose something called conceptual integrity of somebody having a single view of how it works and carrying that all the way through. And doing a short, intense project like this kind of has the benefit of you don't start wandering around, and that and combining with the fact that, you know, this was built by you and, you know, partially by me, and that's it. That's our entire development team. You know, kind of makes things a little easier. We didn't have to fight any political battles in the development of the software factory, which was kind of a refreshing thing.
Well, actually, we didn't have time to wander around, too. The time constraints actually helped stick to the original architecture, because we didn't have time to wander. Think when new problems came up, the conceptually GlidePath was built to be very abstract, and the internals were built to be very abstract and do a number of things, some of which we may not know the end purpose for, because it's up to the content provider to determine that for us. So there's a lot of flexibility to try and fit things into a framework like that you may not have anticipated to start with. And it probably took us less time to fit things into the framework than it would have taken us if we would have wandered off.
Yeah, certainly true.
The time constraint actually helped.
Yeah, I think you're right. All right, well, let's talk a little bit about you know, GlidePath content and what's called a Project GlidePath package. For people who haven't been to the GlidePath website yet, a GlidePath package is the way in which we encapsulate the workflow-based guidance and any additional content that the package developer puts together, and a project template that gets injected into your Visual Studio solution. So from the point of view of building one of these packages, which is something that we're going to be talking about more on the projectglidepath.net website, you know, how hard is it to build a Project GlidePath package?
It can be blazingly simple, but can I give a very short overview of the components of GlidePath.
Sure, absolutely.
GlidePath kind of has three operational units internally. One of them uses the guidance automation extensions to interface to Visual Studio, and that becomes our interface to Visual Studio, and it manages bringing up menu items for us, validating them and things like that. A second functional unit of Project GlidePath is a package of services that manage the information and these packages that GlidePath manipulates. And it talks to the guidance package element and helps get a process started of calling the third element, which are plugins that actually do the work. And the plugins are activated by calling some command through the services interface and call back into the provider's DLLs if the provider has actually written a DLL. And within GlidePath itself, much of the functionality we provide to start with is provided by a particular plugin that we wrote that interfaces to the lower level services. So in order to develop content, it can be, we have something called GCAT, which the content itself consists of a manifest describing the things within the content, some files that are stored for the content provider. One of those files can be a template that gets injected into the project tree for the solution you're working on, and some information about what the commands are that are associated with the menu items in the guidance automation managed solution. We have something called GCAT, which makes it very simple to assemble all of these things in one place and do very simple types of content. Basically, if you had a few PDF files and some links to web pages, things like that, that you wanted in the content that you wanted the developer to see within the project that you're going to provide for something like, let's say, some type of e-commerce solution. You put those files in a directory, in a particular type of directory structure. You run GCAT, and it packages everything up for you. It builds the Visual Studio template. It packages everything up. It has a default plugin, which will get called when one of your actions are activated. So it's pretty simple. You don't even need Visual Studio installed.
Right. And then just for everybody's information, GCAT stands for the GlidePath Content Authoring Tool. And as Craig just said, it's intended to allow people, for example, some of the people that we have working with us are not software developers. For example, PR Web and Digital River. And they're actually able to create GlidePath packages, which are distributed over our RSS feed and installed in your Visual Studio environment, all without having to write a line of code whatsoever. Now, as you mentioned earlier, there's this whole thing about plugins, and while that's one great way to do that, that's not the only way. You're not limited to just providing just straight content, right?
Correct. You can, if you want to do things that are more complex, you can provide your own plugin, which with GCAT we provide a common standardized plugin that handles things based on your custom configuration file that GCAT builds for you. With if you wanted to provide a user interface, if you wanted to provide other types of responses that the GCAT doesn't provide, or that the default GlidePath plugin that handles things like configure that they don't provide for you. You can write your own DLL. The API is exposed. It's very simple. There's one function, I think it's called execute. And it takes as arguments the command that was invoked and something called the context. The context is your window into the world. It's a way of storing data, storing state. Its use is it's there mostly for the use of the plugin rather than the underlying mechanisms of GlidePath itself, and it provides things like access to storage for variables that you want to store between sessions. It can allow you to store variables that will be seen by another module you're going to activate from inside your plugin. It provides access to various services that are fairly common among plugins, and so we expose them through the context. And the command itself, one of the design criteria was that the command should be as much as possible atomic. All information necessary to process that command should be within the command string itself. So you can write a command string that's a simple one-word command, because your plugin is going to handle that unambiguously. You can write a command string that might have XML, that would have a few different pieces of data in there, because that's what you need to start processing. So basically, the content provider who writes their own plugin has a lot of control over over what gets done. They're just told what the user request was, and they're given a context that's the result of either defaults or previous runs of their plugin, and they go and do whatever they need to do. And that includes, you can put up custom user interface, for instance.
And if you're going to build some custom user interface, do you have to get down and dirty and start writing a bunch of C++?
No, the easiest way to do it is just use Windows Forms. They're very simple and straightforward. We have one of the things that the context services gives you is a vector to the graphics thread that's running for Visual Studio. So you can actually bring dialogues and things up within that thread. It's all very, very simple. A custom UI would be the most likely reason I would think that a provider would want to write their own DLL. Although there could be many other reasons also, but the things that you see in GlidePath, like when you say when you choose configure from the menu, what comes up is a Windows form written inside of the GlidePath plugin that handles most of the actions by default that show up on the menu. So, your code is pretty much the same type of situation. You know, just Windows forms displayed within the thread of Visual Studio.
Now, I think one of the other things that we did was we also provided access to what's called the DTE, which is the Visual Studio Extensibility Object Tree and methodology, and that allows you to do things like inject projects into a solution. It allows you to traverse the solution, define things. It allows you to manipulate other Visual Studio things, and so you can effectively do anything you can do with the Visual Studio SDK from the context of being invoked on a particular node in a solution tree. One of the things that you mentioned earlier was this concept of context and storing information. Exactly, how is the information saved between Visual Studio sessions, and is it compatible with more than one person working on a product with source control?
Well, the in theory, you're not supposed to know how where all this magic occurs. But in practice right now, there are, I think, four different levels of context. There is a context that's associated with the project, and you'll actually see that file in your project tree, and there's a context that's associated with the solution. You'll see that in the solution tree. And then there is a context that exists for each individual provider, where they may want to save data about all the content packages they've distributed to that particular system. And there is a global context that anyone can get to from anywhere.
So the packages could essentially, both packages from more than one package from a single provider could talk to each other from in sort of a shared space, and packages in general could talk to each other over the highest level of this context cloud, right?
That's correct. That's correct.
And that's one of the sort of fundamental tenets of what a software factory is, as defined by Jack Greenfield and Keith Short in their book. Just for people's reference, there is more information about software factories in general on the MSDN site. And one of the things that we have yet to fully integrate into Project GlidePath, but we'll be doing as plugins later on, is the whole concept of domain-specific languages, because that's another one of the things about software factories is they're not only intended to provide content, but also tools, which is one of the reasons why we put together this whole plug-in architecture. In the process of all of this stuff, is there anything you'd do different if you had it to do over again?
Well, it's hard to say. When we first started this, there were a number of questions we didn't definitively answer immediately. We kind of defined some place to put these things, and then as things developed, it became more obvious how we were using them currently. So there are a number of abstractions that occurred early on, such as there is an object class that abstracts the iterating over a directory of provider content, because we didn't know whether that might all be stored in the database as objects, or there's going to be on files on disk, etc. So there's an extra layer of abstraction there that in some circumstances I would probably remove. However, some of those extra layers of abstraction could actually prove very useful in the future. So, you know, as things developed, there were things that were done in a more straightforward manner that, given the time and the go-ahead, you know, I might want to carry those abstractions out further, if you follow me.
Right. And so, I can imagine someday, I mean, obviously we targeted Project GlidePath for micro-ISVs in terms of the content, but we targeted the technology for Project GlidePath at potentially a much larger, more robust audience. And to that end, I think that someday there might be possibilities that we could actually implement the some of this context storing things and the content storing things in integration to Visual Studio Team System, as well as with Project GlidePath. And one of the other things I want to mention as well is you were talking about the GlidePath plugin, which handles the update from RSS dialog, that handles the choose, you know, one of the packages installed from a particular viewpoint dialog. And one of the other things that we also did was we built our workflow in a plugin as well, so that you know, we have a standardized, very simple, linear workflow overview and steps model that we built in there. But it's very possible for a particular provider, or even for us, to provide a more complex workflow mechanism in the future. For example, we might someday want to put time durations on various steps and integrate maybe with Microsoft Outlook so that those show up as tasks in Outlook. And these are all the kind of future things we're going to be able to do because we built this plug-in architecture. And in fact, the information in the packages specify which commands get executed by which plug-in so that the default might be, handle the workflow command by the standard workflow plug-in, but somebody building a more complex or a more robust plug-in could say, when the workflow command comes along, I want you to call my plug-in because I want to do this other stuff, or I want to call the workflow version 2 plug-in and so forth. So there's a lot of things that we still have yet to experiment with, and I think that once we start getting other people looking at building GlidePath plugins, and then as we have time to build some more of our own, I think it's going to show that there's a lot of flexibility here that we haven't even been able to really scratch the surface of.
Right, people, there's almost nothing that the user sees that isn't replaceable.
Right, exactly.
In GlidePath, because so much of the work is done in the plugin architecture, the menu items are kind of hard coded and relatively fixed. But beyond that, how they're responded to. I mean, the only reason that our workflow comes up when you pick one of the menu items that bring up the workflow dialog is because that's what the provider specified as the command to handle that when they put their package together. But all of this is customizable.
Right, exactly. All right, well, I think we've kind of run the gamut of starting from why did we do it and how long it took and everything else. Do you want to have any last words to share about how was it working with Microsoft as a small developer?
Well, I don't think that my experience is necessarily typical, because this was an evangelism project rather than a product.
But, true.
It actually wasn't too bad, probably because of it's an evangelism product rather than a product. There were a couple of silly things contractually that I'd like to see changed in the future. Little things which I understand from the point of view of Microsoft having gotten burnt on independent contractors in the past. There are things like not providing hardware, and there were situations within this project where it would have been very quick and easy just to have a machine sent that was set up as we wanted and had network access for me and things like that.
True. And maybe if we get the opportunity to do this again, we can break some more new ground in the whole process. If we get Project GlidePath to take off the way we think it might be, maybe we'll get the opportunity to do a bigger and more robust project.
Right. Well, I might mention that very few. There have been times in the past where, for instance, equipment was provided configured to the client's specification, but Microsoft is not unique in generally not doing that. But it's a handy thing. But there are a few little quirks like that. None of them were unusual from the point of view of the industry. We were pretty much left alone to do what we needed to do, and that's a good thing. So.
Yeah, exactly.
It was generally a pleasant experience.
All right. Well, Craig, thank you very much for coming on the MicroISV show, and we'll look forward to seeing what comes next, both from Crow LLC as well as on the ProjectGlidePath.net website. Appreciate you taking the time, and we will see you again somewhere, I'm sure, on the Project GlidePath forums or on the web.
You can count on it.
All right. Thanks very much.
Okay.